From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Governor Greg Abbott unveils a new border security strategy.
One asked families thinking about sending their kids here, how much did you pay to have your daughter raped?
How the state's multi-billion dollar border wall is failing.
At this pace, it would take more than 20, maybe even more than 30 years to complete the 800-mile wall.
And a Texas town is recovering from a police chief who used his authority to sexually abuse young girls.
How do you report the police to the police?
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On Thursday, Governor Greg Abbott announced the state is launching a new messaging campaign in Mexico and Central America that he said will convince migrants not to come to Texas.
We're here to expose the truth to immigrants who are thinking about coming here, the truth about the traffickers who assault so many of the women and children along the way. We are launching a new campaign to deter illegal immigration into Texas. Yesterday, we began putting up billboards, dozens of billboards, in Central America and in Mexico. They inform potential illegal immigrants about the reality of what will happen to them if they try to enter Texas illegally. These billboards, they tell the horror stories of human trafficking. One says, many girls who try to migrate to Texas are kidnapped. Another sign says, your wife and daughter will pay for their trip with their bodies. One asked families thinking about sending their kids here, how much did you pay to have your daughter raped?
The billboard campaign will have these messages in multiple languages, including Spanish, Chinese, Russian, and Arabic. Abbott estimates the billboard campaign will cost roughly $100,000.
For migrants who are now already close to crossing the border illegally, we have billboards providing warning messages in Mexico. They are arrayed across Mexico, but especially along the northern border of Mexico, all the way from Matamoros to Juarez, and many places in between. One says, stop. If you cross the border illegally into Texas, you will be jailed. Another warns, don't come to Texas illegally. You will be arrested. And know this. The Trump administration will prioritize for deportation illegal immigrants who have been arrested.
It seems unlikely that these people who are attempting to enter the United States are unaware of these risks already. And it is clear that many of these migrants are already facing these risks back in their home countries. So the risk of rape and death is really not new to them. And this isn't the first time that the United States has tried this tactic of warning migrants of these risks as a way to deter them. For example, in 2009, the U.S. Border Patrol commissioned Spanish-language corrido ballots to be written, performed, and recorded that tell similar graphic stories of rape and dying in the desert trying to cross into the United States. These songs were played on radio stations in Mexico as part of their regular music rotation without disclosing that these were paid for by U.S. Homeland Security as a propaganda campaign. The effort showed no signs of reducing the flow of illegal immigration. Also at the press conference, Abbott said that there were rape trees on the border where young women were being gang raped and then they were left to die.
Of what's happening on a daily basis, especially under the Biden administration with the open border policies that have led to so many sexual assaults, murders like what she talked about on this very property, it's a deadly situation. A horrific situation for those who are victims of sexual assault. A horror that we fully expect to end beginning in about a month when President Trump takes office and shuts down the border and restores safety and normalcy to an immigration process.
Other than a pile of ashes, Abbott didn't provide any documents or evidence supporting the claims of these rape trees and mass deaths. He also did not say if Texas authorities have investigated these rape allegations and if Texas was attempting to pursue these horrible crimes. Governor Abbott has also been touting the success of the Texas effort in building its own border wall. But the state has been tight-lipped about where these walls are being built and how much this is costing Texas. Texas Tribune reporter Zach Despart investigated and for the first time is able to provide the details about the border wall program.
So our investigation focuses on the progress that Texas has made on its border wall program that it began 3 years ago. Wanted to do this investigation because Texas is secretive about many of the details about the wall. It's built 50 miles so far, and what our investigation found is the majority of these 50 miles are in rural areas, and rather than one big contiguous wall, these are really several dozen sections spread out over six counties in South Texas. In these sparsely populated areas, mostly built on ranches, in areas where border security experts say are not high priority areas for border infrastructure, they say these high priority areas should be in towns and cities that are easiest for migrants and smugglers to sneak across into, you know, disappear into street grids or into waiting vehicles. The other finding that was major in the story is a third of the landowners that Texas has approached so far in the program have said that they don't want to participate. They don't want to have wall on their land. The program is completely voluntary now, meaning the state has said it will not use eminent domain to forcibly seize land from Texans, which means that the third of landowners who are holdouts pose a serious problem to the success of the program going forward.
Well, there is the Trump wall or the federal government wall. Are they working together? I mean, is it the Texas wall is filling in the gaps for the federal wall?
The state wall is completely separate from the federal wall. During the first Trump administration, the federal government built 21 miles of new wall. The state wall program, which began in 2021, laid out a plan to build 805 miles of wall on the Texas border. That's almost all of the remaining land that's open on the Texas border. So this is separate from any federal plans to do that. We don't know what's going to happen with the second Trump administration that's going to start, obviously, in a few weeks. The state government hasn't announced any plans to scale back or alter its plans to build the state program. But as it stands now, the state plans to keep going forward with its plans. It's built 50 miles. That makes it 6% of its 805-mile goal. But again, with the land acquisition problems, it's unclear how they'll be able to ultimately finish the wall at this point.
So given the fact that they've been working on it for a while, you can kind of gauge their progress. How much time would it take for them to complete the wall?
At this pace, it would take more than 20, maybe even more than 30 years to complete the 800-mile wall. It would cost more than $20 billion to do that. The wall sections cost anywhere from $19 to $41 million per mile. That depends on how rough the terrain is. So it's quite an expensive and time-consuming project.
And the reason why they want a wall, they see this as the ultimate solution to stopping illegal immigration. Is that really the case?
So Governor Abbott pitched Operation Lone Star, his overarching border security initiative, of which the border wall is a part, as a response to President Biden's, what Abbott had cast as President Biden's failed border security plan, his failure to secure the border. Now, of course, President Biden is leaving in a few weeks. So that justification for the border wall no longer exists. Governor Abbott has said that he has faith that President Trump will secure the border and that he wants to give time for President Trump to scale up his border security plans and that he may, you know, want to ramp down Operation Lone Star initiatives that might include the border wall. But he hasn't been clear about what exactly that means. Of course, the state has really barely begun its border wall program. It's hard to measure success of that wall because so little of it has been built. But yes, I mean, the overall plan was to stop illegal immigration via the wall, but it's hard to claim success of that because so little of it has been built.
What is Abbott asking for in the coming legislative session, money-wise, for wall building?
So $3 billion have been appropriated so far for the wall. They've built 50 miles. They have enough money to build another roughly 40 miles. That money is going to run out at some point next year. So in order to continue the program, the legislature needs to appropriate more money. The governor has asked the legislature in his border security request for $2.9 billion. That's for border security generally. He didn't break down specifically how much of that is for the wall, but that would include border wall funding.
So when they say $2.9 billion, they're basically asking for $3 billion, but they don't want to say $3 billion.
Well, I mean, again, that's a proposal. The legislature will debate it. That's not a final figure. We'll see where they ultimately end up on it. We'll also get a better sense of how much of that specifically will be for the border wall. So I would expect that figure to change in one direction or the other as they debate it in the next session that starts in January.
So we've heard from Abbott that having a border wall is a great thing, that it keeps migrants out of your property. It's border security. These are terrible people, criminals who are coming across. You would think that if you were a landowner on the border, that you would be like chomping at the bit. You'd be asking Abbott. You'd be inviting him, please build me a border wall. So why aren't these landowners doing that?
Depends who you talk to. I mean, certainly some landowners do want the wall. The ones we talk to dozens of people who live on the border for this story. Very few of them cast this in sort of ideological lines. It wasn't like they were saying, I like Abbott or don't like Abbott, and that was why I decided to have the wall or not have the wall. Most of them, it was like a land use decision. It was how it would affect, you know, how they lived on the border. For a lot of them, they were ranchers and they were like, well, the wall doesn't affect how I use my land. It wouldn't affect how I, you know, ranch cattle. It wouldn't affect how I hunt, you know, so the wall is fine. Or if they live, you know, have a small parcel and that is their primary home, they don't like the wall, don't want it because it would alter their view. They like living out there because it's peaceful, stuff like that. So there wasn't a lot of ideological discussion about it, but, you know, the crossings have significantly decreased in the past year, and many, many parts of the Texas-Mexico border are very quiet in terms of illegal migration. So a lot of the landowners we talked to along the border have said that we just don't quite get it. We're not asking for the wall. Even some of the big ranchers we talked to who did sign up for the border wall program said, look, state offered me a bunch of money to do it. I said, yes, you know, because I'm happy to take it, but I'm not asking for the wall.
The wall, it's these large metal, they have like slats, vertical slats. I've seen people climb over them myself. You know, are they really that secure?
I mean, I would say that the wall as being built is very hard to get through. The state's building a 30-foot bollard wall. It's the same design as the federal government uses. They're using the same design in part because they're able to buy surplus parts from the federal government. It makes it a little bit cheaper for the state to do. The challenge there is the state is building, it's built so little of it so far that the wall is very hard to get through, but because they've built so little of it, it's very easy to get around. So, you know, migrants, you know, wouldn't have to try to go through the wall or cut through it or climb over it. They would just have to cross somewhere else.
Zach Despart is a reporter with the Texas Tribune. The Texas town of Maypearl has about 1,000 residents, and it's in Ellis County, just south of Dallas. The town put its trust in its police chief, Kevin Coffey, only later to find out that he was sexually abusing young girls in the community, and it wasn't the first time. Washington Post investigative reporter Jen Abelson wrote about it in the story, The Perfect Predator, How a Police Chief Groomed a Small Town.
At first, it was a real mix in terms of people's willingness to speak with us. It was a really difficult experience for the community of Maypearl, and some people didn't want to revisit the past, and others felt like it was really important to learn from what happened there. So we spent a lot of time talking to people, and with the help of Geneva, who is sort of widely seen as the unofficial mayor of Maypearl, and she is the one who ultimately helped speak out for these girls in the community. she sort of helped us, you know, make inroads within the community to help people understand why it was important to speak out and to talk about really difficult and painful things.
Geneva found out about the police chief, Kevin Coffey, as he was grooming a young woman that she was close to. I mean, tell me about that.
Yeah, so Geneva's she's a 49-year-old grandmother. Everyone in Maypearl knows her, and they come to her when they need help. And so what happened in 2015 is she ended up launching a Facebook group when there was this officer in town who was harassing residents, pulling them over. And she launched this Facebook group to help community members come together and voice their concerns. And what happened is after she helped get that officer out of the department, and shortly after that, a 16-year-old girl came up to her and said, "You didn't get the worst officer. He's still there." And she said, "If you fix my broken cell phone, like, you'll find messages from the chief of police, Kevin Coffey."
It was $150 to fix that cell phone. So she really put skin in the game to find out what was going on.
Yeah, there's no person that Geneva turns down when they ask for help. And so her and her husband, Zach, went to get the phone fixed at a local store. And once they were able to, start looking at it, they could see these messages from the chief of police. They were very sexually explicit messages. There were messages that he had sent the teen of his own handcuffs, saying one of these days. And so she was really alarmed at what she had seen. And she sort of ended up setting off this whole investigation. But it took a while. He remained in power for more than 5 weeks after Geneva sort of got these messages and made her first complaint to law enforcement.
And the context of the handcuffs is that there was text messaging saying that he would cuff her and that he would do things to her.
Yes, these messages were very sexually explicit in nature. There were sexual acts that he wanted to do to her, talked about bending her over, smacking her ass, putting her over his patrol car. He started talking to this young girl when she was 14 years old. This is a teenager in his community. And, you know, she found it really difficult to speak up.
Then a whirlwind of people coming forward and saying that they've also had contact with the police chief, Coffey, and the kids had a nickname for him. What was that?
We learned that the kids in town had a nickname for him, and they called him the Creeper. And what was so startling was just how many kids in this community he was targeting and preying on. They were kids of city employees, kids of fellow law enforcement colleagues. They were employees, kids who were coming by, and he would stop by some of their houses. He would send them sexually explicit messages. He would be on Skype with some of them. But he had spent years in this community gaining the trust of parents. As one prosecutor described to us, she called him the perfect perverted predator. And he sort of used his authority to gain the trust of the community and the people around him. He started a Christmas charity event. He checked on elderly neighbors. He really knew how to sort of, you know, prove himself as someone who could be trusted in the community.
Well, that's classic groomer behavior, isn't it?
That is someone who is trying to abuse his position of authority. Yes, it was classic grooming behavior to, use his position to gain access to these kids and gain the trust of the people around him. And even the young girl, Alyssa, like she had some trouble when she was younger. And her parents at first thought he was someone they could trust to help. And over time, became clear that there were problems. And I think what was so troubling for people in the community is that it was a small community. It had just a few cops. Who do you report the police to when it's the police that are doing things like this? Alyssa's mom knew that there was a problem, but she just told her to kind of ignore it. She thought it would stop. She hoped it would go away, but it didn't.
So the deeper story, aside from this disturbing problem that they had in Maypearl, is that Chief Coffey worked in other police departments, many of them, and was dismissed from those departments, accused of misconduct. And then he's just able to be recycled through department to department until he got to Maypearl and went on the behavior that he had there. According to your reporting, Coffey worked at 8 departments in 11 years and was repeatedly accused of misconduct. So why is the system allowing these police officers move around like that?
It's a great question. And it's something that we've seen not just in Texas, but in communities all across America. You know, this story is part of a larger series called Abused by the Badge. And we've, you know, been reporting on this over the past years and looking at systemic failures that have allowed these predators to, you know, commit these acts. And part of it is the failure, not just in background checks, but also sort of what happens when, you know, there is a problem that happens and the officer, and how do they address it? Do they end up pressing criminal charges? Do they, are they transparent with the next agency? A lot of times we found agencies are just, you know, interested in getting rid of the problem. They view it as one bad apple. And once they get rid of that bad apple, you know, it's no longer a problem. But what we've seen is that officers around the country who have been accused of, you know, sexual harassment, sexual misconduct with kids, had other kinds of charges against them, end up getting into other law enforcement agencies. And it's both a department-to-department issue, but it's also within, I think we see at the level of the state licensing and training, sort of what is the level of transparency they require, what is the reporting requirements, and how transparent are they with each other? And it's really problematic. And so one of Coffey's former supervisors told us that he was he got him fired for sexually harassing a teenager, and that was all the way back in around 2004. So Coffey was someone who, as you had mentioned, was at 8 different law enforcement agencies in 11 years, and we obtained hundreds of records from all of these agencies around the state. And at many of the places, it was very clear in the files that there were problems in. Grandview Police Department, for example, he was accused of shooting another officer while serving a warrant, and there was a lawsuit filed that accused him of being poorly trained and supervised. When he was in Hudson Oaks, he was fired. He didn't make it past probation, and when we spoke to his former supervisor, he told us that he had been fired for sexually harassing a teenage girl. He then moved quickly onto a nearby department in Willow Park. And from there, he proceeded to Italy Police Department, where he was terminated, and then he appealed his termination. He went to Johnson County Sheriff's Office, Rio Vista, and eventually landed in Maypearl. And what happened in Maypearl is, you know, Alyssa was the 16-year-old who came forward and talked about the sexually explicit messages, but when the investigation began, it ultimately led to a 14-year-old girl who he had been sexually abusing over the past several months. And she was a 14-year-old girl named Jane. And once Coffey got arrested for abusing Jane, another girl came forward, and her name was Angel. And she was 29 at the time she came forward, and she'd been keeping a secret for the past 15 years. And she revealed that he had abused her while he worked at Grandview, which was all the way back from 2000 to 2003. So this is someone who the records make very clear he had problematic behavior for almost every agency he was at, and still he managed to go from place to place to place.
Should the public have access to these kind of records? These officers, if they've been dismissed from an agency, misconduct, you're out. You know, shouldn't the public know these things?
You raise a really good question, and I think that's one of the points that we're looking at in this series, which is the ability to be transparent and to have some sort of public accountability for this. What we've seen across the country is there's really, you know, there's no universal standards for background checks. There's no public tracking of officers who've been accused of or convicted of sexually abusing children. There's very little training that we've seen across the board that try to help identify red flags and grooming behavior among law enforcement and what to look out for. And we found this to be an issue that in particular that happened among school police in particular, and we did a whole investigation on that. And as a result of our reporting, the U.S. Department of Justice recently issued new federal guidelines, the first time ever, aimed at preventing the sexual abuse and sexual misconduct with children by law enforcement. The lack of transparency around the problems in going from department to department is just one of many different failures that we've seen that exist right now in the law enforcement profession.
So you went to go talk to Coffey in jail. What was that like?
Yeah, so I reached out to Coffey. He'd been in prison for more than 6 years by that point. And when I reached out to him, he was open to sitting down for an interview. So I went with two of my colleagues, a photographer and a videographer. And he sat and for nearly an hour answered questions. And we were really interested to hear what he was going to say. He was found guilty by a jury at his trial in 2017. He was sentenced to more than 40 years.
And what was the charge?
There were two charges. It was the sexual assault of a child and indecency with a child. And he had never admitted any sort of public wrongdoing. He had never apologized. He had never admitted to committing a crime. So we were curious what he would say now that he had spent, 6 years in prison. And when we got there, he, very early on denied that there was any abuse, that there was any exploitation of his authority, and continued to maintain his innocence. And, as the interview went on, he, would say that the abuse with one of the girls never happened. She was never at the house. The house wasn't even built. And then I showed him photos of this girl, Angel, in his house for her 15th birthday. And he admitted that, yes, she was in her house, but she was just there to use the bathroom. And so there was a lot of, struggles for him to explain how he had exploited his authority for so long. We talked about the girl named Jane, and we talked about the messages he sent to Alyssa, who helped start this whole investigation. We pressed him on, were these appropriate to send to a teenager in your community? He had been dismissing them as just harmless banter. But when pressed, he ultimately agreed that, yes, these should not have been sent to her, and he should not have done that. And he did express some regrets. He regretted everything he said that had happened. He said that he should have just left them alone. So he has been in prison since 2017. He still has more than 30 years left in his sentence. And he told us that he had been the target of an attack by another inmate while he was in there. And while prison officials would not tell us any details about the attack on him, we did learn that he has been transferred 8 times since he's been in prison, which is almost as many times as he moved departments.
You know, I always say wherever there's trust, there's trust abused. And this is kind of along those lines. So,
yeah, and I think part of our investigation here, too, is to understand the impact of an entire community and how these kinds of crimes affect not just the victim, but so many people around them. And so that's sort of what we understood here in Maypearl, was this wasn't just about the abuse of one girl or two girls, but this was about what happens when the chief of police, who has the ultimate, power and authority within a community, when he commits an act like that, what does that mean? And how does it betray the trust? I think the other thing that we were really trying to underscore in this piece is how challenging it is in small towns like Maypearl. And I think you see that across Texas, these small towns where there's maybe only one or two officers, and how hard it is for residents to speak up when there's problems, that it felt really difficult to speak up and to challenge what was going on. Alyssa's mom felt it was too difficult. There was another man who had tried to speak out, and he had suffered retaliation and harassment from Coffee that ended up in a lawsuit. So many residents, once he actually got arrested, so many residents came out on the Voice of Maypearl page sort of describing years of harassment and the ways he had exploited his authority, but nobody felt like they could stand up and speak up because it was so hard. These officers and these communities are so deeply embedded. Like I said earlier, how do you report to the police?
Jen Abelson is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org. And you can find us wherever you download cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.